Prodigal Summer, Disc 11.
They sat silent for a while, listening to the wood thrushes. Nanny pulled a handful of cockleburrs from her skirt and then, without really appearing to give it much thought, reached over and plucked half a dozen from the knees of Garnet's khaki trousers. He felt strangely moved by this fussy little bit of female care. He realized vaguely that as a mortal man, he was starved. He cleared his throat. Did it ever cross your mind that God, or whatever you want to call him with your balance of nature and so forth, that he got carried away with the cockleburrs? There's too many of them. I'll have to agree with you on that. Garnet felt faintly cheered. She agreed. You can't blame me for that one, now can you? People spraying or meddling for the cockleburr problem. Oh, I probably could if I tried, but it's a nice day, so I won't. They sat a while longer in silence. Why did they call you? He asked finally, thinking of the woman who had been phoning him up lately for livestock advice. A goat maven, she had called him. He glanced over at Nanny, but she seemed lost in her own thoughts. The church ladies, with their bee problem. Oh, why me and not somebody else? I guess I'm the only one around here that keeps them anymore. Isn't that sad that nobody in this county under the age of 70 knows how to work bees? Everybody used to. Now they've all let their hives go. Garnet did think this was sad. As a child, he had enjoyed putting on the bee bonnet and helping his father with the honey chores spring and fall. He honestly couldn't say why he had let that go. What did you tell them about the honey on the floor? She grinned and looked at him sideways. I'm afraid I wasn't very nice. I told him that the Lord moves in mysterious ways, and that among all his creatures he loves honeybees just about the best. I told him it was in the Scripture. I expect they're all leafing through their Bibles right now to see what it says about God sending down a plague on the killers of bees. What does it say? Oh, nothing. I just made that up. Oh, Garnet said, suppressing a smile in spite of himself. Then they probably just called all the ladies to come down with mop buckets. Nanny Raleigh snorted. What a lot of sweetness wasted on a bunch of sourpusses. Garnet declined to comment. It was that Mary Edna Goins that called me, mad as hops, like the whole idea of a honeybee was my fault. She glanced over at him, then looked away. Mr. Walker, I don't like to say an unkind word about my fellow man, and I hope you won't think I'm a gossip, but that woman has about the worst case of herself I've ever seen. Garnet laughed. He had known Mary Edna Goins since before she was a Goins. Once she had called up to tell him that having goat projects in 4-H was giving young people an undue opportunity to think about Satan. He carefully kept an eye on the cherry tree. We were going to discuss firewood, he said. You can have this one. Thank you, it's mine already, she said primly. Are you going to give me my house and land, too? All right, no need to get huffy, he said. I agree. I don't need that much firewood anyway. I'll take the wood from this one, you take the oak, and we'll split whatever Gerondale charges us to cut up both. He knew better than to accept her offer without thinking it over first. He gazed up into the dimness of her woods and was surprised to notice a sapling waggling its leaves in the breeze, uphill from the creek. Why, look, that's a chestnut, isn't it? He pointed. It is, a young one, she said. My eyes aren't good, but I can spy a chestnut from 100 paces. That one's come up from an old stump where a big one was cut down years ago, she said. I've noticed they always do that. As long as the roots keep living, the sprouts will keep coming out around the stump, but before they get big enough to flower, they always die. Why is that? The blight canker has to get up ahead of steam before it sets off other little cankers and kills the tree. It takes 8 or 9 years out in the open, or longer in the woods where a tree grows slower. The fungus inside there is more or less proportional to the size of the trunk, but you're right. They're just about sure to die before they get up enough size to set any seeds. So biologically speaking, the species is dead. Biologically dead, like us, she said, with no particular emotion. That's right, he said uncomfortably, if we consider ourselves as having no offspring. And unlikely to produce any more at this point. She let out an odd little laugh. He didn't need to comment on that. Now, tell me something, she said. I've always wondered this. Your hybrids are American chestnut stock crossed with Chinese chestnut, right? That's right. And back crossed with American again. If I can keep at it long enough, I'll get a cross that has all the genes of an American chestnut, except for the one that makes it susceptible to the blight. And the gene for the resistance comes from the Chinese side? That's right. But where did you get the American chestnut seed stock to begin with? That's a good question. I had to look high and low, Garnet said, pleased as punch. No one had asked him a question about his project in many a year. Once Ellen had talked her niece into bringing her third-grade class out to see it, but those children had acted like it was a sporting event. Well, such as where? She asked, truly interested. I wrote letters and made calls to Forest Service men and what all. Finally, I located two standing American chestnuts that were still flowering, about as sick and old as a tree can get, but not dead yet. I paid a boy to climb up and cut me down some flowers, and I put them in a bag and brought them back here and pollinated a Chinese tree I had in my yard, and from the nuts I grew out my first field of seedlings. That gave me my first generation, the half-Americans. Where were the old trees? I'm just curious. One was in Hardcastle County, and one was over in West Virginia. Lonely old things, flowering but not setting any seeds because they had no neighbors to cross with. There's still a few around, not many, but a few. Oh, I know it. There were probably plenty back in the 40s, Garnet went on. Do you remember when the CCC was telling us to cut every last one down? We thought they were all going anyway, but now, if you think about it, that wasn't so good. Some of them could have made it through, enough to make a comeback. Oh, they would have, she agreed. Daddy was adamant about that. Those two up here in our woodlot, he was determined not to let anybody get. One night he stopped a man that was up here aiming to cut them down and haul them off with a mule before the sun came up. You had chestnut trees in your woodlot? Garnet asked. She cocked her head. Don't you know the ones I mean? There's the one about a quarter mile up this hill, just awful looking because of all the dead limbs it's dropped. But it still sets a few seeds every year, which the squirrels eat up. And the other one is way on top of the ridge in about the same shape. You have two reproductive American chestnuts in your woodlot? Are you fooling with me? You didn't know? How would I have known that? She started to speak, then paused, touched her lip, then spoke. I never really think of the woods as belonging to us exactly. I walk all over your hills when I feel like it. I just assumed you did the same with mine. I haven't trespassed on your land since the day your father bought it from mine. Well, she said cheerfully, you should have. He wondered if this was really possible, what she was telling him. Certainly she knew apples, but did she honestly know a chestnut from a cherry? He glanced up at the offending cherry tree again and became convinced it was leaning farther than it had been this morning. A squirrel bounded carelessly up its trunk, which was just too much for Garnet. The sound of a loud crack overhead caused him to look straight up, even though he knew better and had long been in the habit of avoiding that movement. Oh, 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 the curse of his dizziness came crashing down. He held his head and moaned aloud as the woods spun around him crazily. He leaned over and put his head between his knees, knowing it would do no good for him to close his eyes. That would only make him want to throw up. Mr. Walker? She leaned down and looked into his terror-stricken face. Nothing. It will pass. A few minutes. Don't mind me. Nothing you can help. But she was still peering into his face. Nystagmus, she pronounced. What? He felt annoyed and foolish and weak and fiercely wished she would go away, but she kept looking right at his eyes. "Your eyes are jerking to the left over and over. It's called nystagmus. You must be having a doozy of a dizzy spell." He didn't answer. The spinning tree trunks were slowing up now, like a merry-go-round winding down. It would pass in a few more minutes. "Do you get it in bed, too, lying on your back?" He nodded. "That's the darndest. It wakes me up if I roll over in my sleep." "You poor thing. That's a misery. You know how to fix it, don't you?" He moved his head very carefully to face her. "There's a cure?" "How long have you had this?" He didn't like to say, forever. 20 years, maybe." "You never saw a doctor for it?" she asked. "At first, I thought it must be something awful gone wrong inside my head," he confessed. "I didn't want to know. Then the years went by and it didn't kill me." "It won't. It's just a nuisance. BPV is what they call it. Benign positional vertigo or something close to that. I can't remember. Rachel had it bad. Usually old people get it, but you know, everything on Rachel that could fall apart did. Look, here's what you do. It's simple. Lie down here on this log." He protested, but she already had him by the shoulders and was guiding him down onto his back. "Turn your head to the side as far as it'll go. Let it drop backward a little, down off to the side. That's right." He gasped and clutched at her hands like a baby when the dizziness descended again, worse than ever. No matter how he braced for it, that feeling of careening through space never failed to terrify him. "It's okay, that's good," she crooned, holding onto his hand with one of hers while she cupped her other palm behind his head, steadying him. "Stay there if you can stand it. Just hold right still till it stops." He did as he was told. It was a minute, maybe two, before the world slowed and arrested its dance. "Now," she said, "roll your head straight back till it starts up again. Don't be scared. Go slow and freeze when it hits you." He became so terribly aware of her hands. She was holding his head in her competent, tender grip, like a mother pressing his face against her skirt. It was all he could think about as he passed through one more bout of dizziness, then turned his head and endured another. He wondered if he would ever be able to look Nanny Raleigh in the eye after this. "You're almost done," she said. "Now, listen, I'm going to help you. Sit straight up and tilt forward like this." She put her chin on her chest to demonstrate. "Ready?" She helped lift him back to a sitting position and guided his head forward. He waited, feeling a strange sensation of reassembly in his head. When it passed, he relaxed his shoulders, raised his head, and looked around at a world that seemed to have been made new. She watched him intently. "Okay," she said. "You're done."
"Done with what?"
"You're fixed. Try looking up." He was skeptical, but he did it cautiously. He felt a faint of movement, but it was small. Compared with the usual, it was hardly anything, no real dizziness. He looked at her, astonished.
"Are you a witch? What did you just do to me?"
"It's the something maneuver. Epley, maybe?" she smiled. "Rachel and I discovered it by accident. I used to roll her around and tickle her to distract her from her dizzy spells. Then a long time later, Dr. Gibbon told me there was an easier way to do it and a name for it. You'll have to do it again every so often, maybe every day at first."
"What did you fix?"
"It's caused by these little tiny crystals."
"Oh, don't even tell me. If it's your hocus-pocus theory of everything."
"No, now listen. It's little hard crystals like rocks that form in the balance what's-it thingamabob inside your ear. That's a scientific fact."
"Well, how did they get there?"
"Some people just get them, that's all I can tell you. What do you want me to say, that they're caused by orneriness? Listen here, old man, did I fix you up or not?"
Garnet felt chastened. "Did."
All right, then. Listen to me for a change. You've got you some little rocks in there that float around and make trouble if you tilt your head the wrong way. The trick is to roll them up into a dead-end corner where they can't get out and bother you. Are you sure? Is this real, what you're telling me?
Real as rain, Mr. Walker.
All these years?
All these years, that's been your trouble.
You've had rocks in your head.
They sat without speaking for a long while, listening to the gasoline-powered sounds of an oak turning into a cord of wood. At length she asked,
"Would you like to walk up on the hill with me and see those two chestnuts? Would it do you any good to have two more seed sources for your breeding program?"
"Do you have any idea?" he asked, amazed and excited once again. He'd momentarily forgotten the chestnuts.
"It would double the amount of genetic variation I have now. I would have a faster, healthier project by a mile, Miss Raleigh, if I had flowers from those two trees."
"Consider them yours, Mr. Walker, any time."
"Thank you," he said.
"That's very kind of you."
"Not at all."
She folded her hands on her lap. Garnet could picture the two old chestnuts up there, anomalous survivors of their century, gnarled with age and disease, but still standing, solitary and persistent for all these years, just a stone's throw from his property. It was almost too much to believe. He dared to hope they still had a few flowers clinging on this late in the summer. What that infusion of fresh genetic material would do for his program, it was a miracle. In fact, now that he thought about it, if those trees had been shedding pollen all along, they might already have helped him out, infusing his fields with a little bit of extra diversity. He thought he'd been working alone. You just never knew. He turned his head to the side and received an unbidden picture of the rocks in his head, stashed out of harm's way for the moment, but poised, surely, to roll back out and make trouble. Without meaning to, he also remembered the stack of green shingles in his garage, hiding there, burning a hole in his conscience like a cigarette dropped on a couch. Chapter 21. Moth Love. One of the skills of grief that Lusa had learned was to hold on tight to the last moments between sleep and waking. Sometimes, then, in the early morning, taking care not to open her eyes or rouse her mind through its warm drowse to the surface where pain broke clear and cold, she found she could choose her dreams. She could call a memory and patiently follow it backward into flesh, sound, and sense. It would become her life once again, and she was held and safe. Everything undecided, everything still new. His arms were real, carrying her over the threshold as he joked that she weighed more than one bag of groceries, but less than two. Cicadas buzzed, and the air was hot and sticky. June, just after the wedding. She still had on her blue rayon skirt, but had taken off her stockings and shoes in the car on the drive down from Lexington. The light blue skirt flowed like cool water over her thighs and his forearms as he carried her up the stairs. He stopped on the landing, kissed her there, and slid his hands under her so her whole weight was nothing held in his hands. She was weightless, floating in air with her back to the window and his strong arms beneath her thighs. The air around his head seemed to shiver with the combined molecules of their separate selves as he entered her and she gave in to the delirium of flight, this perfect love made on the wing. Sometimes the dream changed itself then, and his comforting presence had the silky pale green wings of the stranger who had first come to her after the funeral, on the night Jewel gave her the sleeping pill. He always said the same thing to her. "I know you." He opened his wings and the coromata rose from his abdomen, fragrant and intricately branched like honeysuckle boughs, and once again she felt the acute pleasure of being chosen. "You knew me well enough to find me here," she said.
And his scent burst onto her brain like a rain of lights, and his voice reached across the distance without words. "I've always known you that well." He wrapped her in his softness, touched her face with the movement of trees and the odor of wild water over stones, dissolving her need in the confidence of his embrace.
"Aunt Mariedna says they're praying when they do that," Chris reported doubtfully.
"I guess you could say that. Butterfly church."
Lusa and Chris had stopped in the dirt road to admire another dense crowd of swallowtail butterflies congregated on the ground surrounding a muddy spot. Every 50 feet or so, they came upon another of these quivering pools of black and yellow wings that rose and scattered as they approached, then settled again on the same spot after they'd passed by. It had rained again yesterday, so there was no shortage of puddles.
"I'll tell you something, though," Lusa said. "It's a no-girls-allowed church. All those butterflies you see there are probably boys."
"Why?" "What why? Because they have little peckers."
Chris yelped out her sharp bark of a laugh. Lusa lived for this, to crack her up. It had become her pet secret challenge, to try for these moments when you could see all the lights come on, ever so briefly, in this child's dark house.
"I know what you meant," Lusa said. "Why do just the males do that? It's called puddling, believe it or not. That's what real-life bug scientists call it."
"Yeah, why do just the boy ones do it?"
"They're sucking up a certain mineral or protein from the mud, some special thing butterflies need to be healthy. And then they actually give it to the girl butterflies, like a valentine."
"How do they give it to them?"
Lusa paused, then asked, "Do you know how babies get made?" Chris rolled her eyes.
"He sticks his packer in her pee hole and squirts in stuff, and the baby grows in there."
"Okay, you know the story, all right. So that's how he gives her the minerals. When he gives her the baby-making stuff, he actually puts it together with this whole package of other goodies she likes. It's called the spermatophore."
"Boy, that's weird."
"Isn't it? You know what? Nobody else in Zebulon County knows that, except you and me. Even your teachers don't." She glanced up.
"Really?"
"Really. If you want to know about bugs, I can tell you things you will not believe."
"Are you mad at me for saying pecker and shit and stuff?"
"Nah, not at all. Hell no," she swore to make Chris laugh. "As long as you know where not to say those words, like in church or at school or within 1.5 miles of Aunt Mariedna. But here, who cares? It won't hurt my ears."
"Well, hot damn," the child declared. "Shit fire. Hey, don't use them all up in your first 5 minutes."
Chris picked up a small stone and tossed it toward the crowd of butterflies, just to see them rise.
"Come on," Lusa said. "Let's hunt moths. Today I'm going to find you a Luna moth or bust."
They walked slowly toward the puddle, passing straight through the cloud of quivering butterflies the way Lusa remembered Superman walking between the molecules of a wall in the cartoons. She and Chris were hiking up the old cemetery road into the woods behind the garage, for no reason in particular, just out for a little adventure, while Lowell napped on the parlor couch. Jewel was having a very bad day and had asked Lusa to watch them for the third time in 2 weeks. Lusa was happy to oblige, though she wondered what kind of a parental substitute she was, encouraging Chris to swear like a tinker, for instance. She didn't know the first thing about kids. But no one else in the family could get a word out of Chris at all. "You get what you get in this world," as Hanny Mavis had once told her. Lusa and Chris had gotten bad luck and the judgment of the righteous, and apparently each other.
"What's that?"
Lusa looked into the woods where Chris pointed. Birdsong rang like bells in the rain-washed air, but Lusa couldn't see anything in particular.
"What, that plant?"
"Yeah, at Booger One, climbing up the trees."
"Booger One?"
Chris shrugged.
"Uncle Ricky says them's boogers, them vines that gets all over everywhere. He hates them."
"This one's nice, though. It's supposed to grow here. It gets covered with white flowers at the end of summer, and then it makes millions of seed pods that look like little silver starbursts. It's called Virgin's Bower."
"Virgin's like Jesus's mama, right?"
"Right. or any girl or woman who's never gotten the pecker business we were talking about.
Oh, virgin's power?
No, virgin's bower. It means her bed. Lusa smiled. Same thing in this case, actually. Chris leaped ahead of Lusa with a dozen or so strange, stiff giant steps. She seemed to like trying out different ways of walking, which Lusa just watched, bemused. She was wearing the same outgrown pair of jeans she always wore now, and also, today, a strange ragged creation over her T-shirt. It looked like a man's denim work shirt with its tail and sleeves cut to ribbons with a pair of scissors.
"I like bugs better than flowers," Chris said decisively, after a while.
"Good, then you're in luck, because I know a million times more about bugs than I do about flowers. And we're looking for a Luna moth, remember? Look on the trunks of the trees, on the side that's in the shade. Do you know what a hickory tree looks like, with the really shaggy bark?" Chris shrugged. "Luna moths especially like hickories, those and walnuts. They lay their eggs on the leaves because that's what their caterpillars eat."
"How come?"
"That's just how their stomachs are made. They specialize. You can eat the seeds of wheat, for instance, but not the grass part."
"I can eat all kinds of stuff."
"Other animals should be so lucky. Most of them have pretty specialized diets, meaning they can only eat one exact kind of thing."
"Well, that's dumb."
"It's not dumb or smart. It's just how they're built. Like you have two legs and walk on your feet. A dog probably thinks that's dumb." Chris didn't comment.
"But yeah, specialization makes life more risky. If their food dies, they die. They can't just say, 'Oh, never mind, my tree went extinct, so now I'll just order a pizza.'
Lowell has that."
"Has what?"
"The special food problem."
"Yeah?"
Lusa was amused by this analysis of her brother. "What does he eat?"
"Just macaroni and cheese, and chocolate malted milk balls."
"Well, that is a specialized diet. No wonder he didn't eat my lentil soup the other night. I should have put malted milk balls in it."
Chris let out a tiny laugh, just air escaping between her teeth.
"Look here on the mossy side of this tree. See these little white moths?"
They both bent close as Lusa prodded gently at a translucent wing. The moth roused and crawled a few inches up the rough bark. Chris was backlit by the sun, so Lusa could see the pale down on her curved cheek like the fuzz on a peach. There was a softness to her features in these moments of concentration that made Lusa wonder how so many adults, herself included, could ever take this child for a boy. She looked up.
"What are they?"
"These are called cankerworms. The worm stage got noticed first with these guys, so Mama Moth is stuck with not such a nice name. She's kind of pretty, though, isn't she?"
Lusa let it crawl onto her finger, then held it up and blew on it lightly, sending it fluttering in a crooked arc toward another tree. Chris stood for a minute longer watching its sleepy colleagues on the tree before she was willing to move on.
"How come you know so much about bugs?" she asked.
"Before I married your Uncle Cole and moved here, I used to be a bug scientist in Lexington. I did experiments and learned stuff about them that nobody knew before."
"They got a lot of bugs in Lexington?"
Lusa laughed. "As many as anywhere, I guess."
"Huh. Aunt Lois said you was a miner."
"A miner?
Gold miner."
Lusa puzzled over this. "Oh, a gold digger." She sighed. This time she was sure Chris hadn't meant to hurt her.
"Is it true?"
Chris asked.
"Nope. No gold mines for me, past or future. Aunt Lois has got her head up her butt on that particular subject."
Chris closed her mouth in a tight, conspiratorial grin and rolled her eyes at Lusa. They were finding their ways of living with the judgment of the righteous.
"This is a good spot. Let's look up here,"
Lusa said, pointing up a steep embankment to a grassy clearing above the road, bathed in dappled light. They'd come as far up this road as she wanted to go. They shouldn't stray too far from the house, since Lowell was napping alone. Also, Lusa really didn't want to face the family cemetery that waited around the next bend. Cole wasn't in it, but too many other Wideners were. Chris was already scrambling ahead of her through the plumes of the daylilies that had escaped from someone's garden long ago and were now as common as weeds. They were pretty, though. Their strap-like leaves spilled like waterfalls over the banks, crowned with circles of bright orange-eyed flowers and long, graceful buds. They grew in bobbing rows along nearly every unmowed roadside in the county, punctuated with the intermittent purple pink of sweet peas. Before they started to bloom a few weeks ago, Lusa had never noticed either one of these plants. The whole county was one big escaped flower garden. Chris yanked the head off one of the lilies as she mounted the bank. "Watch this!" She rubbed its center against her chin before tossing the bedraggled flower on the ground. "Very nice. Now you've got an orange beard," Lusa observed. Chris attempted an evil grin, touchingly childish.
"Like the devil."
"You know what that is, that orange stuff? Pollen. You know what pollen is?" She shook her head.
"Sperm."
Lusa exaggerated the word thrillingly.
"Ew, yuck!"
She wiped her chin fiercely. "Don't worry, it won't make you get pregnant and have flowers." She walked past her to the edge of the clearing where a stand of hickories had caught her eye. She began to search the tree's north side systematically, moving deeper into the woods. Chris trailed along behind her at a little distance.
"Do you think it's like going to hail?"
she seemed to be asking. Lusa glanced up at the bits of sky she could see between trees.
"No way, there aren't any rain clouds in the sky." "I'm talking about hail,"
the child insisted. Lusa moved deeper into the woods, scanning limbs and the undersides of leaves with a practiced eye. "It takes a big storm to bring hail. Why do you care anyway? You don't have a crop in the ground."
"Hail, I said."
There was enough frustration in her voice to bring Lusa out of her own thoughts and make her turn around. Chris had her feet planted and was glaring at her, aggravated. "What about hail?"
"Hail,"
the child said, frankly annoyed. "Where the devil's at?" Lusa slowly turned over this mystery. "Are you asking me about hell?" The child shrugged.
"Just forget it."
"Well, I'm sorry. I guess we kind of missed our moment there to talk about the afterlife." Chris had tromped ahead, yanking sassafras leaves off the bushes as she passed. "I'm just curious," Lusa said, catching up to her. "How do you tell the difference between hail that falls from the sky and hail where the devil is?" Chris stopped and looked up at her, stupefied.
"Duh, they're spelled different."
"Oh," Lusa said. "Duh." Chris studied her for a moment.
"Ain't Lusa, did you know you talk really funny?"
"Yeah, it's starting to sink in." Lusa cajoled Chris into sparing the sassafras bushes and helping her look for a Luna instead. "It will be the biggest green moth you can imagine. They're amazing." Chris seemed unwilling to believe in the possibility of finding magic, here or anywhere, but she did come running when Lusa finally let out a yelp and cried, "Oh, look, look, look!"
"Where?"
"Way up there. It's too high for us to get. Do you see it, though? Right in the crotch of that branch sticking out." Chris squinted, seeming less than impressed.
"We could poke it with the stick."
"You don't want to hurt it," Lusa argued, but she'd already had the same thought and was twisting a long, skinny limb off an oak sapling. She reached as high as she could, jumping a little, waving the switch like a broom to brush against the hickory trunk just below where the Luna rested with its wings serenely folded. It twitched a little and took flight. They watched it dip and climb high into the branches until it was gone. Lusa turned to Chris, her eyes shining.
"That was a Luna."
Chris shrugged.
"So?" "So? So what? You want it should sing, too?"
Chris laughed, and Lusa felt a little startled. They took her by surprise, these moments when her Zeta slipped right past her father's guard into her own tongue. "Come on, let's go look in the grass for things we can get our hands on." She led the way back to the grassy clearing on the bank above the road and flopped down in the center of it. She was content for a minute just to lean back on her elbows and look at the toes of her sneakers and past them, down through the enticing woods. She'd been cooped up in the house or weeding or mowing or checking the health of her goats for too many days. She ought to get herself into the woods more often. The grass in this clearing was a little damp. She could feel it soaking her shorts, but the sun felt so good. She closed her eyes and tilted her face toward the sky.
What's this one?
Lusa leaned over and looked closely at the shield-shaped green bug that Chris had coaxed onto her wrist.
Southern green stink bug, Lusa pronounced.
Chris studied it closely.
Does it stink?
That's a matter of opinion.
Is it kin to that red and black one we found on the peach tree?
The harlequin bug?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. Same family, Pentatomidae.
She looked at Chris, surprised.
That's very good. You have a really good eye for this. Did you know that? You're a good observer and you remember things well.
Chris flicked the bug off her wrist and rolled over onto her stomach, looking away from Lusa. She parted the grass carefully with her hands, here and there, like an animal grooming its kin. Lusa left her alone, rolling over to study her own patch of grass. Chris eventually gave up the chase and lay on her back, staring into the treetops. After a while, she declared,
"You could cut down all these trees and make a pile of money."
"I could," Lusa said.
"Then I'd have a pile of money and no trees."
"So, who needs trees?"
"About 19 million bugs, for starters. They live in the leaves, under the bark, everywhere. Just close your eyes and point, and you're pointing at a bug."
"So, who needs 19 million bugs?"
"19,000 birds that eat them."
"So, who needs birds?"
"I do. You do."
She so often wondered whether Chris was really heartless or only trying to be.
"Not to mention the rain would run straight down the mountain and take all the topsoil off my fields. The creek would be pure mud. This place would be a dead place."
Chris shrugged.
"Trees grow back."
"That's what you think. This forest took hundreds of years to get like this."
"Like what?"
"Just how it is. A whole complicated thing with parts that all need each other, like a living body. It's not just trees. It's different kinds of trees, all different sizes in the right proportions. Every animal needs its own special plant to live on, and certain plants will only grow next to certain other kinds. Did you know that?"
"Sang only grows under a sugar maple tree."
"What does?
Ginseng? Where'd you learn that?"
She shrugged again.
"Uncle Joel."
"So he's a sang digger, is he?"
She nodded.
"Him and his friends like to go up there on the mountain and dig it up. There's a lady up there hollers at him for it, too. You're not supposed to dig it up. He says she's probably fixing to shoot his hide if she catches him up there one more time."
Lusa looked up the mountain. "Some lady lives up there? Are you sure?"
"That's just supposed to be Forest Service land above this farm."
"Ask Uncle Joel. He'll tell you. He says she's a gall dang wild woman."
"I'll bet. I think I'd like to meet her." Lusa poked an inchworm out of the grass and let it make its way up her finger.
"What does Uncle Joel say about me? Is he the one who thinks I should cut down my trees?"
She felt only slightly guilty about exploiting this new source of inside information.
"No, he's the one says you've gone plumb goat crazy."
"Him and everybody else. They're all just dying to know why, aren't they?"
Chris shrugged and looked over at Lusa, a little guarded, but she nodded.
"I guess you wouldn't tell, though."
"I'd tell you," Lusa said quietly. She would love to give this child a gift that mattered. Her confidence, that would be something.
Her face lit up.
"You would?"
"Only if it was just you, not Uncle Joel or anybody else. You couldn't tell them no matter what."
"Can you keep a secret? Cross your heart?"
With earnest solemnity, Chris drew a cross on her chest.
"Okay, here it is. I've got this cousin in New York City. He's a butcher, and we've made a deal. If I can get all those goats up there on the hill to have babies a month before New Year's, he'll pay me so much money for them, your Uncle Joel will keel over."
The child's eyes grew wide.
"You'll be rich?"
Lusa grinned and hung her head.
"No, not really. But I'll be able to pay the guy who's redoing all the plumbing in the house and that friend of your Uncle Ricky's who's fixing the barn roof right now."
"Clevis Morton?"
Chris made an awful face.
"He's got B.O.
Lusa tried not to laugh.
"Well, that's no reason not to pay him, is it? If so, I just wasted $900 because I wrote him a check this morning."
Chris seemed astonished by this figure.
"Shit far, I guess now he's rich."
"It takes a bunch of money to keep a farm in one piece. Sometimes you don't make as much in a year as you have to pay out. That's why people moan and groan about farming, just in case you were wondering."
What if your goats don't do that, have their babies? I'll still have to pay Clevis Morton a whole bunch more money when he's finished, whether or not he takes a bath. Lusa lay down on her back in the damp grass, crossed her arms behind her head, and sighed. It's risky, but the goats are the only way I could think of this year to make some money off a little patch of briar scrub and keep the farm in one piece. She glanced at Chris, who didn't seem to be listening, though it was hard to tell. So that's what I'm doing with the goats, just trying to keep my little piece of heaven from going to hell. Uncle Joel said you was throwing the place away. He's welcome to make a suggestion if he has a better idea. He and my vegetarian friends Hal and Arlie in Lexington, who've informed me I'm a sellout. There's not one crop I can put in the ground here that will earn as much as it costs to grow, other than tobacco. Chris looked at her. Are you that? Am I what? Veg-arian? No, I'm one of the other Christianities, as your cousin Ricky put it. Chris had taken up a stalk of long grass and was very lightly touching Lucy's skin in the spot where her t-shirt rode up and exposed her belly. It was the closest thing to intimacy she'd ever seen this child share with anyone. Lusa held her breath and lay very still, stunned by luck, as if a butterfly had lit on her shoulder. Finally she breathed out, feeling a little dizzy from watching the high, thin clouds race across the blue gap in the trees overhead. Listen to me moan and groan. I guess I must be a real farmer now, huh? Chris shrugged. I guess. If my goats don't work out, I'm what you call screwed. I hate to think about it. I'd feel like a murderer logging this hill. But I'm not sure how else I can keep this farm. Chris turned suddenly from Lusa and tossed the grass stem away. Why do you have to keep it? That's a good question. I'm asking myself that question. You know what I come up with? What? Ghosts? Chris leaned over and peered down into Lusa's face. She looked puzzled, briefly, before her expression went neutral. That's stupid. Not really. You'd be surprised. Chris pulled a handful of grass out of the ground. Ghosts of who? People who've lost things, I think. Some are your family, and some are from mine. Real people? Dead people? Yes. Like who? My Zeta, my grandpa on my dad's side. Once upon a time, he had this beautiful, beautiful farm, right? And people took it away from him. It was a long time ago, before I was born. My mother's grandparents had a farm, too, in a whole different country, and the same thing happened. Gone. Now they've all wound up here. Are you scared of them? Chris asked quietly. Not at all. Do you really believe in ghosts? Lusa wondered why on earth she was talking about this with a child, but she needed to speak of it, as badly as Chris needed to curse. They both had their reasons. She sat up and looked at her until at last she caught her eye. I'm not scaring you, am I? The girl shook her head rapidly. Maybe I shouldn't even call them ghosts. It's just stuff you can't see. That I believe in, probably more than most people. Certain kinds of love you can't see. That's what I'm calling ghosts. Chris wrinkled her nose. Would you do then smell 'em? I do, and hear them. I hear my grandfather playing music when it rains. That's how I know he's here. And your Uncle Cole's here, too. I smell him all the time. I'm not kidding. 3 or 4 times a week, I'll open a drawer or walk into the corn crib in the grain house, and there he is. Chris looked truly unhappy. He's not there for real, though. If you can't see him, he's not. Lusa reached out and rubbed her shoulder, a hard little point of bone beneath a tense little blanket of muscle. I know. It's hard to think about, she said. Humans are a very visual species. What's that mean? A monarch butterfly drifted into the shaft of light in front of them and batted lazily into the cleared path through the trees toward the fields below. Lusa said, What that means is, we mainly love things with our eyes. You mean like Ricky does with those girl magazines under his bed? Lusa laughed hard. That is exactly what I mean. They both watched the monarch, a bouncing orange dot, receding downhill until it was nothing, just a bright spot melting into the light of day. A lot of animals trust their other senses more than we do. Moths use smell, for instance. They don't have to see their husbands or wives at all to know they're there. So, you're not a moth. So, I guess you're right. Pretty stupid, huh? Chris shrugged her shoulders. When you die, will you be a ghost hanging around here too? Oh yeah, a good one. And who'll be here then after you? That's the $64 question. The ghosts of my family and yours are having a big disagreement over that one. Mine say stay, yours say go, on account of who comes after me. I have no idea how to make everybody happy. Chris studied her. Which side do you figure to pick? Lusa stared and shrugged back at her, the same quick, introverted jerk of the shoulders that Chris kept ready at hand to answer all questions, a stolen gesture. Come on, she said then, jumping up and pulling Chris up by the hand. We better go see if Lowell's awake. He'll still be asleep. He'd sleep forever if you let him. Maybe he's just a little sad about your mom. Sometimes people need to sleep more when they're sad. She reached over to give Chris a hand down the bank into the road cut, but the girl took the plunge by herself in one huge leap. Not me, she said, landing on her feet. No, what do you do? Lusa climbed more slowly through the daylilies down onto the road, feeling like the turtle trailing the hare. Nothing, I don't think about it. Really, not ever? Chris shrugged, then caught herself at it. They didn't speak for several minutes as they walked side by side downhill, through puddles of light in the road spilled by gaps in the forest canopy. Every 50 feet or so, they scattered up another cloud of swallowtails. The choir boys turned out of church. Lusa liked the idea of butterfly church. Frankly, it was no more far-fetched than the notion of a communal sucking up of sodium for sperm valentines. She wondered what would happen if she submitted a paper to behavioral ecology on the spiritual effects of swallowtail puddling. Lusa was still amusing herself with the idea when they rounded the corner above the house and she was stopped dead in her tracks. Oh no, look, she cried. Shit, Aunt Lusa, the damn booger honeysuckle's at your garage. Lusa could not think of a better way to put it. The mound of dark green leaves was so rounded and immense there was hardly any sign that a building lay underneath. An ancient burial mound, Lusa might have guessed. A Mayan temple crumbled to ruin. Could this really have happened in just one wildly rainy, out-of-control summer? She hadn't been up the cemetery road for as long as she could remember, and certainly hadn't looked at the garage from the backside since before Cole's death. Now she could only stare, recalling the exact content of their argument about the honeysuckle before he was killed, the absurd newspaper column about spraying it with Roundup, her ire on the plant's behalf. How could she have gotten so sanctimonious about honeysuckle? It wasn't even native here, it occurred to Lusa now. It was an escapee from people's gardens, like the daylilies, like most weedy things that overgrew, in fact. No local insects could eat it because it was an introduction from someplace else. Japan, probably. Lonicera japonica, that would be right, like Japanese beetles and chestnut blight and the horribly invasive Japanese knotweed and the dreaded kudzu. One more artifact of the human covenant that threatened to strangle out the natives. You have to persuade it 2 steps back every day, he'd said, or it will move in and take you over. His instincts about this plant had been right. His eye had known things he'd never been trained to speak of. And yet, she'd replied carelessly, take over what? The world will not end if you let the honeysuckle have the side of your barn. She crossed her arms against a shiver of anguish and asked him now to forgive a city person's audacity. Her head filled with the scent of 1,000 translucent white flowers that had yellowed and fallen from this mountain of vine many months before. Maybe years before. Chris was looking up at her so anxiously that Lusa touched her own face to make sure it was still intact. Don't worry, it's nothing, she said. I saw a ghost. Chapter 22, Predators. Dog days. Deanna sat on her freshly completed bridge in the hemlock grove, nervously picking off splinters from the end of a pine plank and tossing them into the water, listening to the clan of redtails screaming at one another up in the sky. Sometimes the birds dipped into the trees overhead, and their reflections glanced briefly across the surface of the water below her feet. She pulled her bandana out of her back pocket and wiped sweat out of her eyes, leaving a trail of grime and sawdust across her forehead. A hawk goes blind in the dog days, people used to say, and her dad said different. Nothing about a hot summer day could make a bird lose its sight. They're pushing their young out of the nest in August, is all. The parents fly around crazy, diving into the treetops to try to get away from their full-grown young, following them around, screeching to be fed, unwilling to hunt on their own. Her dad didn't know the word fledge, but he knew what it meant. Look close, he always used to tell her. If it doesn't sound true, it isn't. There's always a reason for what people say, but usually it's not the reason they think. Deanna was at a loss to invent any more work for herself today. Nothing she'd be able to keep her mind on anyway. She'd finished this bridge. She'd also collected 4 wheelbarrow loads of firewood from the pile here, where they'd cut up the trees, and pushed them all the way up to the cabin. She'd cleared weeds and retrenched the steepest part of the upper mountain trail. She had run into a pair of hikers up there on the ridge, a young, very dirty couple who seemed delighted with the world and each other. They'd wandered over here as a side trip from the Appalachian Trail. Hiking the whole AT this summer from Maine to Georgia was their plan, as they'd eagerly relayed it to her. They'd gotten this far, worn out a pair of boots each, and were looking forward to picking up a care package from one of their mothers, including new boots, down where the trail came out in Damascus, before continuing on south. They thanked Deanna, impressed with the upkeep of the trails here in the Zebulon Forest, as if she'd done all the work just for them, which answered one of the 2 questions she'd been asking herself all summer, anyway. As she watched the pair hike away in their baggy, colorful shorts, she wondered how that would feel, to have a mother leaving you care packages when you ran out of boot leather, or to hike hundreds of miles beside another person, always knowing which way the trail ahead of you ran and exactly how far. He was sitting up there right now in the green porch chair, reading her thesis. She had not felt this nervous since the day of her final oral defense, when her committee made her go out in the hallway while it deliberated her case. This humidity had to break. There was a storm in the air, which was probably making the hawks act up even more. She didn't want to be down here when it hit. In her tenure on this mountain, she'd been caught outside in a lightning storm exactly twice. Once she'd made it into the shelter of the big chestnut log, back when it was still her own. And the other time she'd had to cower against the trunk of a hemlock in the lowest spot she could get to. Both times had been more awful than she liked to admit. He was right about her and thunder. She wasn't afraid of snakes, but thunder paralyzed her. There wasn't any reason, it just was. Even as a girl, she dreaded loud noises, could not fire a gun without breaking a cold sweat, even just for target practice at a can on a fence post. Her dad used to sit with her through storms. Eddie had done that, too, and almost the same way, though she didn't tell him so, rubbing her back as she lay with the pillow pulled over her head, counting out loud with her the distance between flash and boom, 1/5 of a mile per second. If not for that, she thought, this would be easy. If not for those nights and early mornings and half minutes when he was suddenly kinder and truer than seemed possible, given everything, given what he couldn't understand. What did she really think he would do now, when he finished reading the book of her knowledge and beliefs? Change? No. Tear his hair for guilt? No. Stay or walk out the door? Which did she want him to do? That was the question. When a body wanted one thing wholly and a mind wanted the opposite, which of the two was she, Deanna? She leaned far forward from the bridge so she could see her face in the water. Her braid swung over her shoulder and hung down, nearly touching the water, swaying like a bell rope. "Pull me in," she said silently to the girl in the water. "Make up my mind for me. Take from me this agitation, the likes of which I have never known in all my life." This morning she had wept for no reason she could possibly name. The forest hadn't seemed large enough for her grief. She'd startled up a white-spotted, flag-tailed fawn and sent it crashing down mountain from the bed of leaves where its mother had carefully hidden it. Deanna curled herself into the spot it had fled and sensed the small body's warmth still there in the brown leaves. There was no loss here, she told herself. The fawn would bleat for its mother and be found. But she'd suddenly felt so despairing and tired, such an utterly lost cause, that she'd lain on the ground and put leaves in her mouth. Bang! A thunder boom hit now like a hammer on the back of her spine, jerking her up onto her feet on the raw wooden planks of the bridge. She was grateful for that, at least, one decision made for her. By the time the second boom hit, rolling up the hollow like a wave and crashing over her head, her feet were already headed up the mountain. They would get her to the cabin before lightning arrived. What do I want? What do I want? Her feet on the trail demanded. The rhythm of her breathing demanded. If she couldn't say what she wanted, she could say nothing, wouldn't look at him, would have to go on feeling trapped with him in that place, like predator and prey closed tight in a box, waiting for word on which was to be which. She was breathing hard by the time the cabin came into sight. Why had she been getting out of breath at the drop of a hat lately? Was that age, too? Was she running faster than she used to? Through the trees, she could just see the south face of her house, where the logs had been completely overgrown this summer by a single Virginia creeper vine. She'd pondered whether to rip the hairy little tendrils off the logs or just leave them there to protect the old wood from wind and rain, like a lively green skin. She angled up the hill, coming up on the cabin from the back. Her mind was running ahead of her and off to the side, but it snapped back when she saw something odd at the place where the roof gable butted against the uppermost log in the cabin's wall. The small hole there she'd noticed before, but now something was moving out of it, a dark loop. She approached slowly, catching her breath and keeping her eyes on the spot. She could see now exactly what it was. The cabin's summer-long resident guardian angel who kept down the mice, the devil who took the Phoebes, the author of that slow sandpaper sound in the roof, her black snake. He was leaving. Deanna planted her feet and watched the entire, unbelievable length of him pour out the small hole in the side of the roof gable. He oozed down the log wall in an undulating liquid flow, like a line of molasses spilling over the edge of a pitcher. When most of his length had emerged, he suddenly dropped into the tall grass, which trembled and then went still. Then he was gone, for good, just like that. Today, of all days, for reasons she would never be able to know. Whether she had loved or hated this snake was of absolutely no consequence to his departure. She considered this fact as she watched him go, and she felt something shift inside her body. Relief, it felt like, enormous and settled, like a pile of stones on a steep slope, suddenly shifting and tumbling slightly into the angle of repose. The pounding of "What do I want?" went still in her breast. It didn't matter what she chose. The world was what it was, a place with its own rules of hunger and satisfaction. Creatures lived and mated and died. They came and went, as surely as summer did. They would go their own ways, of their own accord. Chapter 23. Old Chestnuts. Garnet had made up his mind. He was going to tell her about the shingles. Today, he would tell her. Nothing was going to get him off the track this time. She could go ahead and be rude, shocking, or blasphemous. It wouldn't matter. He was still going to give her those shingles. He was a Christian man, hovering near 80, and there was no telling when a fellow his age might just keel over. It had happened to younger men, Lord knew. It was not going to happen to Garnet Walker with those shingles moldering in his garage and the sin of spite staining his soul like an ink blot. Maybe, while he was at it, he would remember to thank her for the pie. As he walked across his yard toward the gate, he paused to take stock of a pokeberry weed that had shot up in the ditch beside his driveway, out of reach of the mower. He'd been meaning to get down here with the weed whacker, but somehow this poke plant had slipped past his good intentions and grown into a monster. It was a tree, practically, 10 feet tall, dangling its big, slick leaves and bunches of green berries. All that growth accomplished in just 4 months, from the ground up, since Poke was killed to the ground by frost. He stood with his hands on his hips, scrutinizing its purple trunk. He hated a weed on principle, but could not help admiring this thing for its energy. His eye wandered up toward the row of trees that towered along the fence row, giant leafy masses like tall green storm clouds, and he felt unexpectedly awestruck. A man could live under these things every day and forget to notice their magnitude. Garnet had gradually lost the ability to see individual leaves, but he could still recognize any one of these by its shape. The billowy columns of tulip poplars, the lateral spread of an oak, the stately upright posture of a walnut, the translucent, effeminate tremble of a wild cherry. The small, lacy locusts were faintly brown this late in summer, and the catalpa at the corner post wore a pale green color you could pick out on a hillside a mile away, or even farther when it was dangling all over with the long pods that made people call it a bean tree. The sourwood had its white flowers reaching out like skeleton hands in the spring. Trees. Every kind assumed a different slickness in the rain, its particular color in the fall, its own aspect, something you couldn't describe in words but learned by heart when you lived in their midst. Garnet had a strange, sad thought about his own special way of seeing trees inside his mind and how it would go dark, like a television set going off, at the moment of his death. What in heaven's name was he doing out here in his driveway looking at trees and thinking about death? He started to turn back toward his house, but from the corner of his sight he registered the rounded shapes of the regularly spaced apples beyond the fence row and knew, of course, that was it. His mission was Nanny Raleigh and the shingles. He thought of going to the garage to check on them first, just to make sure they were in a condition to be offered, but he suspected he might merely be postponing the inevitable. "Just pull up your knickers and go, young man," he scolded himself and obeyed. He found her in back of the house, where he knew she would be. He'd been keeping an eye out this morning and had seen her carrying an old locust fence rail back there. He'd actually grown a little curious about what she was up to, though he knew curiosity had killed the cat, and that was probably even without the assistance of Nanny Raleigh. She waved merrily when she saw him coming. "Mr. Walker! How's your BPV? His what? Was she asking him about underwear? Fine, he said with reserved commitment. No more dizzy spells. That's wonderful. I'm happy to hear it. Oh, that, he said, and the memory of her firm, tender hands cradling his head sent a shock of adrenaline through his old body. He'd had a dream about her, so real to him that he'd awakened plagued with the condition he hadn't known for years. He blushed now to recall the whole business again. He nearly turned tail and ran. Are you all right? Much better, yes, he replied, getting his bearings. I'm not used to it yet. I was so used to getting dizzy, it's taken me a while to get used to not being dizzy. That's old age for you, isn't it? She asked. If I got out of bed one morning and my knees didn't hurt, I'm not sure how I'd know to walk. He stared at her, distracted. She wasn't wearing much. He'd noticed that earlier when he saw her dragging the locust rail up from the ditch. Just a little yellow, sleeveless blouse sort of thing, and short pants. Short pants on a woman of her age. It was hot, but not so hot as to drive a person to indecent exposure. I prayed about that dizziness, he confessed to her. For several years I did. God moves in mysterious ways, she replied breezily, probably without meaning it in the least. Next, she'd be suggesting she was the answer to Garnet's prayers. Personally, I've found that my prayers seldom go unanswered, he said, a little more haughtily than he'd meant. Last August, when it was so dry and so many people were about to lose their tobacco, I got down on my knees and prayed for rain, Miss Raleigh, and I want you to know, the very next evening, it rained. She looked at him strangely. Right before you came over here, I had a sneezing fit. I guess my sneezing caused you to come. That's a very peculiar thing to say, Miss Raleigh.
Isn't it, though?
She replied, turning around and taking up her hammer again. I take it you don't put much stock in miracles.
I'm not in a position to believe in miracles, she said, without turning around.
She sounded a little angry, or perhaps just a little sad. She was building something, all right, working on that locust rail he'd seen her dragging about. Now she had it propped up onto a sawhorse here in the doorway of her garage and was nailing a crossbar to it. Goodness, it looked like the cross the Romans had used for crucifying Jesus Christ. He wasn't going to ask. He made his mind up on that. His second vow of the day. He'd better get to the first. He cleared his throat and then said, for no good reason, "Did you know there's a pokeberry bush by my driveway that must be 11 feet tall? I've never seen the like." She paused her hammer and turned back around, eyeing him carefully. "Is that what you came over here to tell me?" He thought about it. "No, it's just an incidental piece of information." "Oh, well, that's something, an 11-foot pokeberry. If they gave out an award for weeds at the county fair, you'd have a contender there. Wouldn't they all be surprised? Garnet Sheldon Walker III, first place in the weedy annual category." The usual good cheer had returned to her voice, and he couldn't keep from smiling a little himself. Poke was a half-hearty perennial, not an annual, he was pretty sure, but he refrained from correcting her. "If I'd thought about it," he said with mock seriousness, "I'd have given it a little ammonium nitrate. I think I could have gotten it up to 14 feet. She put down her hammer and seemed to relax. Her trousers, he could plainly see, were a pair of old work pants cut off with scissors. What a thing to do. "You know what I really admire this time of year?" she asked him. "I wouldn't dare to guess, Miss Raleigh." "Blackberry canes," she said. "Now you go ahead and laugh at me because everybody else does. I know they're an awful nuisance, but they're amazing, too." "I expect they're the fastest growing plant this side of China," he said. "Yes, sir. They shoot up out of the ground, and by mid-June, they're 8 feet tall. Then the top starts to bend back down to the ground, and by August they've made an arch of a size to walk under if you wanted to. Did you ever notice how they do that?"
"I've noticed and noticed," he said. "I've gone through about 8 bush hogs in my lifetime noticing how blackberries grow."
"I know. I'm not defending 'em. They'd eat up my whole orchard if I didn't keep 'em cut back to the fence. But sometimes, in winter, I just have to stand back and stare at those arches going down the road, up and down, like a giant quilter's needle sewing its way across Zebulon County, one big arched loop per year. You can love them or hate them, either one, but there's no stopping 'em."
She looked at him sideways, like a mother scolding.
"And you have to admit, the berries make the best pie there is."
He flushed.
"Oh, I've been meaning for the longest time to mention that pie. I thank you for that pie." Short pants on a woman of her age. From what he could see, she had the legs of a much younger woman. Certainly not what he would have expected in the way of Unitarian legs.
"You're welcome," she said. "Better late than never. If recent trends continue, maybe I'll bake you another one next year." He looked at her long and hard, wondering frankly if they would both be here next summer. After a certain point, you had to think that way. "Miss Raleigh," he declared, "I can't say as I've ever seen short pants on a woman your age."
She looked down at her knees, which were maybe a little pale and knobby on second thought, if one were to pay attention. She looked back up at him with a girlish grin. "I got hot, Mr. Walker. I got inspired by the UPS boy. He drives that truck in nothing but his swimming suit. I figured if that's legal, then surely an old lady can take a pair of scissors to her old khakis once in a while."
Garnet shook his head. "Dignity is the last responsibility of the aged, Miss Raleigh."
"Fiddlesticks, death is the last responsibility of the aged."
"Don't get fresh with me," he warned. "And don't expect to see me running around in short pants, either."
"I'd sooner expect to see a pig fly, Mr. Walker."
"Well, good then," he said, but then asked,
"Are you saying I'm a pig?"
She crossed her arms.
"Are you saying I'm immodest?"
"If the shoe fits," he replied curtly.
self-righteous, tedious, she said. There's a couple of shoes you can try on. That was it, then. They had stooped to name-calling like a pair of grammar school children. He took a deep breath. I think I'm finished here. No, you're not, she said firmly, looking at him with a menacing eye. Tell me what's wrong with me. Let's just get it out. All these years you've been picking at me like a scab. What have you really got against me? She stood there fearless, daring him to tell the truth, exciting him toward actually doing it. Garnet turned the thought over in his mind and sighed. With profound sadness, he understood that he could never tell her the answer because he didn't know it himself. He said feebly, "You don't act normal for your age." She stood with her mouth a little open, as if there were words stuck halfway between her mind and the world around. At last they came out. "There isn't any normal way to act 75 years old. Do you know why?" He didn't dare answer. Was she really 75, exactly? "I'll tell you why," she said. "Considering everything, the whole history of things, people are supposed to be dead and buried at our age. That's normal. Up till just lately, the Civil War or something, they didn't even know about germs. If you got sick, they slapped leeches on you and measured you for a coffin. I wouldn't doubt, but hardly anybody even made it to 50, isn't that so?" "I suppose it is." "It is. Our Mamma and Papa got to keep their dignity, just working right up to the end and then dying of a bad cold one day, with most of their parts still working. But then along comes somebody inventing 6,000 ways to cure everything, and here we are old, wondering what to do with ourselves. A human just wasn't designed for old age. That's my theory." He hardly knew what to say.
"That's one of your theories."
"Well, think about it. Women's baby business all dries up. Men lose their hair. We're just a useless drain on our kind. Speaking strictly from a biological point of view, would you keep a chestnut in your program if it wasn't setting seeds anymore?" He frowned. "I don't like to think of myself as obsolete." "Of course not. You're a man. Men walk around with their bald heads bare to the world and their pony put out to pasture, but they refuse to admit their dead wood. So why should I? What losses I have to cover myself up for shame of having a body this old. It's a dirty trick of modern times, but here we are. Me with my cranky knees and my old shriveled ninnies, and you with whatever you've got under there, if it hasn't dropped off yet. We're still human. Why not just give in and live till you die?" Garnet was so hot under the collar he could scarcely breathe. He had never sworn in front of a woman in his life. Not since grammar school, anyway, but this was a near occasion. She was asking for it. Nanny Raleigh needed a will o' switch, was what she needed. If they'd both been 65 years younger, he'd have turned her over his knee. Garnet swore a silent oath, turned on his heel, and walked away without so much as a word. For an occasion like this, there just weren't any words that would do. An hour and 10 minutes later, Garnet returned to Nanny's backyard with one asphalt shingle in his hand. She was carrying a bushel of Gravensteins to her pickup truck, starting to load up for the Amish market tomorrow, and was so startled to see Garnet Walker that she stumbled and almost dropped her basket. He held up the shingle, showing her the peculiar heart-shaped profile that matched the ones on her roof, and then he threw it at her feet. It lay there in the grass next to a puddle, this thing she needed, like a valentine. A bright crowd of butterflies rose from the puddle in trembling applause. "There are 200 of those in my garage. You can have them all." She looked from the shingle to Garnet Walker and back to the shingle. "Lord have mercy," she said quietly. "A miracle."
This ends Disc 11.